All right, don't forget, we got Bocce Ball coming up. Before that, we heard Warren Zevon with Mohammed's Radio. You're listening to The Point Is. I'm Sue Hildebrand, and we're back. We're now joined on the phone from Los Angeles by Sonali Kolhatkar. Sonali is host of the Pacifica radio program Uprising on KPFK in LA. She's co-author of the book Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington Warlords and the Propaganda of Silence. And she is the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, a group that works in solidarity with Afghans to help improve health and educational facilities for Afghan refugees in Pakistan. It's really a pleasure to welcome you to The Point Is, Sonali Kolhatkar.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, Sonali, could you tell us, just give us a kind of an on-the-ground understanding of what is happening in Afghanistan right now? I know that's a big question, but what's going on? It's sort of been out of our, you know, off the radar for a while.
We can start with just what's happening on the government level in Afghanistan. The current president, Hamid Karzai, who is very much backed by the U.S., but who was democratically elected, is facing re-election in March. His parliament has been dominated by extremely corrupt warlords and criminals who have really taken over much of the north and east part of the country, both politically and militarily. They have their own private militias. They are extremely misogynist, and essentially they're ideologically similar to the Taliban. Very few women who are allowed to serve in government can speak up. Those who have spoken up have been censured or kicked off the parliament. Judicially speaking, women are being imprisoned in greater numbers than they were during the Taliban era for so-called honor crimes because the judiciary is very fundamentalist. They were appointed by Karzai with the blessing of the U.S. Militarily, of course, in the south and west part of the country, the Taliban dominates. They are growing in number, and they have recruited a lot of people who are extremely upset and angry about the very high civilian casualty toll by the United States and NATO. The U.S. and NATO is U.S. and NATO forces are occupying the country. They're bombing. They're going door to door. They're shooting at civilians. They're detaining people. And they're extremely unpopular now. There's a majority in Afghanistan that does not want them there, whereas just a few years ago, they were welcome for the most part. But their actions have led Afghans to realize that these forces are not working in their interests. More ordinary Afghans who've lost their families have joined the Taliban. And the Taliban are, of course, carrying out where they can their own misogynist actions and edicts, burning down girls' schools, throwing acid in the faces of women who dare to go to school. Poverty and maternal mortality, unemployment are still sky high, among the worst in the world. Infant mortality is terrible. Healthcare is non-existent. The little educational institutions that are present are being run either very poorly or, if they serve girls, are being burned down. So it's a pretty bad situation all around. I mean, that's just scratching the surface of what's happening in Afghanistan. But broadly speaking, it's a grim situation.
Well, let me ask you, before I called you, one of the listeners called in, and he's a dedicated listener. I love to hear from him every week. But he called in and he said, you know, Afghanistan is very complicated, and it is very complicated. But one of the things that I want you to go into further, because it is so confusing, is you said that the presence of the U.S. forces are driving Afghans basically into the arms of the Taliban. What that blows my mind. What is it that the Taliban has to offer people in Afghanistan?
Well, it's not that people are going into the Taliban ranks because they love the Taliban. It's very difficult for us Americans to put ourselves in the shoes of Afghans. But just think about this. If you are an Afghan who's lived in the country all your life, you've been facing war since 1977, when the Soviets first invaded, when the U.S. poured money into the Mujahideen. these fundamentalist warlords, many of whom are now in parliament. There was a 10-year-long bloody occupation during which millions were killed, 1.5 million Afghans killed over 10 years. After that, when the Soviets left, you had another 5 years of bloody civil war where tens of thousands of Afghans were killed by these fundamentalist warlords with U.S.-provided weapons. And then in 1996, to try to deal with, banking on the violence of the last several years, the Taliban steps in saying, we will provide stability. Now, people know that these are fundamentalists, but they are so desperate, they accept the Taliban. The Taliban imposes their version of fundamentalism and some kind of rule of law in Afghanistan. And there is a relative peace, but it's the peace of a prison. Afghans are completely subjugated and oppressed. And then the U.S. comes in after 9/11 and defeats the Taliban, bringing back into power these warlords. Ordinary Afghans have very few options. The only options they ever offered are foreign forces or fundamentalist warlords, either from within their own country or Pakistan. And in the middle, they have bloodshed. They are caught in the nets of these various fighters. If people are being driven towards the Taliban, it's because they have no option, because the U.S. and NATO forces are actually killing more civilians. It's like choosing between the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the Taliban are popular. People mm-hmm. hate the Taliban. Mm-hmm. Ordinary Afghans hate the Taliban. But what does one do when one's entire family is obliterated by the U.S. and NATO?
Well, Sonali Kolhatkar, let me get your response. I already know what you're going to say, and I think we all know what you're going to say. But what is your reaction to President Obama announcing that he plans to increase troop levels by 17,000? Is that a good idea?
Well, to me, what it says is that there's just no understanding of the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. Maybe President Obama needs to surround himself with people who really know what's going on there, who've studied the history, who've studied the recent history, who understand. I mean, even the Pentagon generals who have been involved in Afghanistan understand better what's going on the ground than Obama does. If he thinks that throwing more troops into the mix is going to solve the problem, he's really fooling himself, because the troops are part of the problem. The very presence of the troops, their actions, their conduct is what has increased violence there. Now, if he were to say, I'm going to increase the number of troops and I'm going to change how the troops behave on the ground, I'm going to completely change their operating procedures, I'm going to completely change the attitude and the interaction with Afghan people, then I would stop and say, well, okay, let's think about this. But his only other accompanying policy change is the idea, and you may or may not have heard of this, the idea that they're going to try in Afghanistan what they tried in Iraq, which is to arm local militias to fight the Taliban. And Hamid Karzai, sadly, is backing this as well. But huge numbers of Afghan experts and on-the-ground people are saying that is the worst thing you could do. Because what was happening before 9/11, you had a war on in the country where 10% of the country was controlled by the Northern Alliance, who were private militias, who were fighting with weapons from other countries, and the rest of the country is controlled by the Taliban, and there was a war going on. We came in, we defeated the Taliban, and now 8 years later, we're saying, oh, let's go right back to where we started, which is armed private militias fighting the Taliban. The only private militias in the country who one could arm are the militias of these extremely corrupt war criminals who have the blood of tens of thousands of Afghans on their hands. And they're going to be given the weapons to fight the Taliban. That's not only rewarding them for their good behavior, but it's resigning the country to, endless years of continued bloodshed. That's Obama's idea, and it's extremely short-sighted, and it's extremely foolish. And what it does is it promises to increase the bloodshed not only among Afghans, but even U.S. soldiers.
Well, let me ask you before I ask you about possible goals of our effort in Afghanistan, I want to ask you, what would you guess would happen if the U.S. said, if President Obama said, you know, we're just going to pull our troops out, our very presence, if he actually was listening to this program today and said, you know, pulling our very presence there is only causing more anger, only causing more violence, only making this problem worse. Let's just pull out. What would you guess would happen if the U.S. slowly pulled out of Afghanistan?
Well, as your listener who had called in earlier said very accurately, Afghanistan is a very complex situation. The U.S. owes a great deal to the Afghan people. We have spent billions of dollars and many years destroying that country, contributing actively and directly to the destruction of that country by pouring in weapons for decades. Now, the war in Afghanistan didn't start on October 7th, 2001. It started in 1978 when we began the funding of the Mujahideen against the Soviets. And we owe the Afghan people a complete taking back of those arms. We have proxy armies on the ground right now in the form of those private militias. So my solution, my advice to President Obama is taking the troops out of Afghanistan is the first step towards peace in Afghanistan. All that does is it ensures that there are no more civilians killed by our forces, but it doesn't ensure that there are no more civilians killed by our proxy forces. Now, it used to be that the argument for justifying troop presence in Afghanistan was security, that, oh, if we pull our troops out, these fundamentalist forces, the Taliban, are just going to kill Afghans, so we have to be there to protect them, except we're killing Afghans right now. So you take our troops out as the first step. But then the United States owes it to the Afghan people to fully fund the United Nations disarmament program, take all the weapons out of there, to support Afghan efforts to put on trial these war criminals that have destroyed Afghanistan, who are cronies of the United States, who are proxy soldiers of the U.S. They deserve to be tried for war crimes. And Afghans have said this in polls themselves. The majority of Afghans identify as victims of war crimes and would like some kind of war crimes tribunal, because these men occupy political power in this country and are squelching real democratic efforts. If they're allowed to just remain in Afghanistan, Afghans will never have the chance to get elected and enjoy true democracy. So we have to support their efforts, Afghan-led efforts, to put these men on trial, because they are our responsibility. We need to, for dollar, the money we've spent on weapons, we need to give, and I don't mean loans, I mean grants to the Afghan people, reparations to help them rebuild their infrastructure that has been destroyed by years of American-sponsored war, schools, orphanages, health clinics, hospitals. For a huge amount of money we spend on the military, we just spent the tiniest token drop in the bucket on infrastructure building, which is what Afghanistan desperately needs. It's a country decades behind, say, Iraq, in infrastructure. Those are some of the steps that will start Afghanistan back on the path to peace. And our safety and security here in the U.S. is deeply connected to that of the Afghan people, as we found out on 9/11. If the Afghan people are suffering at the hands of fundamentalists, ultimately those same fundamentalists will come and get us here in the United States. So it is in our interest that the Afghan people remain safe from fundamentalism, because we can't just resign them to it. You know, we have to do something about their peace and security. So it's a complex and lengthy process, but it's taken us decades to destroy that country. It's going to take us decades to rebuild it.
Right. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Point Is. We're talking with Sonali Kahatkar, who is a radio host at Uprising on KPFK in LA. She's also the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. Sonali, let me ask you, some of the things that you're talking about now remind me, kind of the main idea of what you're talking about, remind me of the reasoning that Greg Mortensen talks about, his work in Pakistan, through his book, Three Cups of Tea. And in a nutshell, he simply says, if you provide schools, particularly to girls, they will better their lives, and you cut off the opportunity to recruit desperate people in Pakistan. Is that similar to what you're saying? I mean, is it sort of that desperate situation, that vacuum, that opportunity for the Taliban to take hold in Afghanistan that has allowed this situation back in 1978?
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, definitely, you know, education, particularly education for girls, is one of the major factors that a country's progress should be measured by. When girls and women have, you know, a lack of education, the entire country is set back. Women and girls' suffering is deeply connected to the suffering of children, which is deeply connected to the health of the country, both physical health but also moral health of the country. And so absolutely, that's a really big factor here. And, you know, the Taliban, who were sponsored by Pakistan, and the Mujahideen, who were sponsored by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, these forces, these fundamentalist forces, both from inside and outside Afghanistan, you know, they got the bulk of weapons and political power in Afghanistan. It would be like as if an outside country, I don't know, China or Russia, came to the U.S., and armed the KKK and every extremist neo-Nazi group they could find in this country to the teeth, gave them all sorts of weapons so that they could dominate the country first militarily and then politically. You would see an ideological shift in this country, too, just like you saw in Nazi Germany. I mean, that's the kind of ideological shift that has happened in Afghanistan over years of fundamentalist rule. Now, that's not to say that ordinary people are necessarily all fundamentalists, but it has become a country that started out conservative, certainly, and has become deeply fundamentalist. I mean, the majority of people think Sharia law is a good idea, but then they mean Islamic law. They mean Islamic law that is, you know, fair and just. They don't mean Sharia law in the interpretation that the Taliban and the warlords interpret, which includes, you know, death for adultery and imprisoning women for being victims of rape. And burning women alive for this, you know, mere act of trying to run away from an unhappy marriage. So those are the kinds of things that you know, we need to sort of understand the influence of the Taliban and how it's connected. It's really the responsibility of these foreign countries who've imposed these fundamentalists onto the Afghan people.
Well, your analogy using China coming to the U.S. and arming the KKK really is a very powerful analogy. I think I get it. I think I finally understand what has happened here. Well, I want to turn a little bit to stated or unstated goals of trying to be in control of Afghanistan, that region of the world. Are there any, as far as you can tell, stated or unstated goals of our adventures in Afghanistan? What is it? Is it simply to protect U.S. citizens from attacks by the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, or is it something different?
Well, you know, if you go back to the U.S.'s original involvement, Afghanistan became a battleground for the Cold War. Afghanistan became that convenient fighting ground on which the U.S. could defeat the Soviet Union. And essentially, that's exactly what happened. After 10 years of occupation and war, the Soviets withdrew and then promptly within a few years collapsed entirely. Essentially, what U.S. officials openly said was they were going to give the Soviets their own Vietnam, the implication being that Afghans would suffer the same fate as the Vietnamese had during our occupation and invasion of that country. So that was the goal back then, you know, just use Afghans as a sort of bleeding ground for to defeat the Soviets. Now, once that goal was achieved, the U.S. just abandoned Afghanistan. They just left all those weapons there, and they didn't care even about the Taliban entering Afghanistan. Under Bill Clinton's rule, which is when that happened in Afghanistan, they essentially ignored. I mean, at first they even made positive gestures towards the Taliban, thinking it would be a force for peace and stability in the country. But then, after 9/11, suddenly it became our problem that the Taliban were oppressing Afghans. And basically, in my opinion, just from all my research, I don't think the Bush administration really had a clear goal in Afghanistan. They never wanted to go to Afghanistan. They didn't care about Afghanistan. They had their sights set on Iraq right from the start. But they realized that it was going to be politically impossible for the U.S. to go to Iraq right after 9/11. It took them 4 days, in fact, of discussions and decisions negotiating to realize that they couldn't go straight to Iraq, that the only direct connection that they could make was Afghanistan because of al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan. And so Afghanistan became a sort of stepping stone to Iraq to buy some time to convince the public that the U.S. really needed to go to Iraq. The Bush administration, through all of their connections to oil and gas industries, really ended up never banking on any of the opportunities Afghanistan presented through its geopolitical place in the world. Afghanistan doesn't have any natural gas and oil, but it's surrounded by countries that are oil and gas rich. And the Bush administration never really took advantage of that. In fact, it's Canadian companies and Russian companies that have taken advantage of that. So I think the Bush administration didn't really have a clear-cut goal in Afghanistan, but that's, you know, very consistent with that administration's MO, if you will. But in the long term, I think Afghanistan is going to be very important for the U.S. in terms of permanent military bases, which it has right now in Afghanistan. The U.S. has never before had permanent military bases in that part of the world. Russia and China are right next door to those bases. The U.S. has never had bases that close to Russia and China, and it's sort of an insurance policy for the future, if you will. Mm-hmm. And maybe U.S. corporations will in the future take advantage of our presence there by trying to do deals with the Taliban as they did under Clinton's rule. UNOCAL tried to deal with the Taliban for a pipeline from the oil-rich Central Asian countries through to Pakistan. So maybe they will take advantage of that, but I don't think that's necessarily a goal or a political goal just yet.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Sonali Kahatkar, who is radio host for Uprising down on KPFK radio out of LA. I want to just throw it out there and thank all the folks that made the point is possible during this hour. This hour was made possible by memberships, by member contributions, and by the Chico Certified Farmers Market, linking local farmers with the community. You can find year-round Farmers Market in Chico every Saturday morning at 2nd and Wall Streets from 8 a.m. till 1 p.m. And you can get more information about the markets by calling 893-FARM. Sonali, I want to ask you, I've been learning a little bit about the 18th century, the Great Game, and that race for controlling Afghanistan. And it sounds like this is simply a continuation geopolitically of controlling that area. Am I right in thinking that?
Afghanistan historically has been, sadly, a country that has been militarily occupied, you know, decade after decade by different countries. You know, its fate is that it lies in the heart of Asia. Afghanistan is basically in the heart of Central Asia. And over the decades, over the centuries, it has been a country that has been occupied by Russia, by the British, by the Soviet Union, by the United States, over and over again. If you go even further back, you can, you know, read the ancient history of Afghanistan and see that that's, you know, Genghis Khan also was present in Afghanistan. Afghanistan has this history of being dominated over the centuries by different civilizations. It has a very, very rich history. But the Great Game, which sort of refers to the kind of battles that were fought over Afghanistan as though it was as though Asia was a grand chessboard, was definitely something that was replayed in the 1980s, and it may be replaying right now. I mean, it's sadly the situation, sadly the fate of this very impoverished, very mountainous, arid country, but devastatingly beautiful country as well, that it becomes this sort of political football over history.
Well, I read a book years and years ago before I really paid much attention to politics, and I read a wonderful book by James Michener called Caravan, and it's all about traveling through Afghanistan. And as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to go to Afghanistan for exactly the reasons that you've talked about. There's so much culture there, and it's so devastatingly beautiful. But I think it's a while before I might actually make it there. Well, you know, first of all, let me just say this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. You're listening to The Point Is, and we're talking with Sonali Kahatkar. And Sonali, let me ask you this. I just learned the other day, I was told that there is actually an organized, thriving peace movement in Afghanistan. Do you know much about the work that's happening from the peace movement there?
Well, I should first say that, you know, any kind of movement that is challenging the power of the fundamentalists is necessarily an underground movement. It's very dangerous to organize in Afghanistan today. Most of the people who have had any kind of education have and any means have either fled the country, because why would anybody want to live in a war-torn nation if they had the opportunity to escape? So, you know, the people who are left behind are extremely impoverished. The vast majority of Afghans are illiterate, you know, something like 96% illiteracy among Afghan women, and who are struggling to make ends meet. In such conditions, it becomes so difficult to organize. But despite that, you're right. There are journalists, there are students, there are political activists who are organizing underground in Afghanistan. We may never hear of most of them here in this country, because if they were to operate openly, they would be facing great risk to their lives. But I can certainly tell you about the group of women that I have worked with over the last 8 years, whose work has really drawn me into doing Afghanistan research and doing solidarity with Afghan people. It's the work of RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan. And this is a group of women. This is basically the oldest women's political organization in the country. They were formed over 30 years ago to further women's rights. Over the years, they have changed their goals to include emancipating their country from foreign occupation, as well as struggling for women's rights. They're an organization of only women, or only based in Afghanistan and or the neighboring country refugee camps in Pakistan or Iran. And they are organizing on a social and a political level. Social level includes humanitarian work, such as the orphanages and hospitals and income-generating projects and literacy courses for women and all of the, you know, sustainable farming projects. And then the political work involves publishing a quarterly magazine, organizing demonstrations, publishing political statements, confronting the United Nations when they can, and just in general, trying to rebuild their country from the inside out. And this group of women are absolutely remarkable. They travel incognito. They do not, their founder, Mina, an amazing young university student, Kabul University student, was killed in 1984 by a collaboration between the Soviet Union and the Afghan fundamentalists, because she represented a threat to both these forces. And since then, the members of RAWA never reveal their names, never get photographed, travel underground when they can, and are basically carrying on Mina's work. And it's extremely dangerous work, and they need all the support that they can get. And that's one of the simple things that Americans can do, is to support the efforts of groups like RAWA. Well, they have a website at rawa.org.
Well, I was just going to ask you, Sonali, what specifically, how can we help? And I want to give you an opportunity to talk a bit about the organization that you're very involved in, Afghan Women's Mission. So how can people listening literally assist in this work and assist in your work?
Well, Afghan Women's Mission was formed in 2000 by myself and two others here in the United States to specifically financially support RAWA's work. I mean, we discovered RAWA. We were so incredibly impressed by their work. We met a couple of their members when they came to the U.S. for the first time, their first ever U.S. tour. We helped organize it. And our goal, our mission, if you will, is to educate Americans about RAWA and about the situation in Afghanistan, and to raise funds for RAWA as a direct political act in terms of solidarity with Afghan people and helping them rebuild their country. And so people can either make direct donations. We have a monthly pledge program. They can sponsor an orphan in RAWA's orphanages, which I've personally visited. I myself sponsor an orphan. It's an amazing, amazing way to do something positive in Afghanistan. They can hold house parties, do a viewing of documentaries. We offer one very good documentary through our website, and you can raise money for RAWA that way. You can organize your own fundraisers. So there's a number of different ways. You know, people sometimes say, well, I don't want to just give money. Well, guess what? The money is going to a really good cause. And, you know, we need money in this country to do simple things like educate ourselves and rebuild our country here, and that's exactly what Afghan people need. It's the simplest thing you could do. So people can get involved. They can tell their friends about RAWA. So Afghan Women's Mission is simply the sort of nonprofit means for RAWA to raise money here in the U.S.
And what is the web address for your organization so people can go there and learn more about it and maybe even contribute some cash?
Absolutely. I would love it if people could do that. Our website is AfghanWomen'sMission.org, AfghanWomen'sMission.org. And through that, you can get RAWA's website, which is also RAWA, RAWA.org. And, you know, we've got a lot of books and videos and other resources as well as RAWA on their website. So definitely check it out and share that with your family and friends. A lot of people I know are trying to figure out what to do about Afghanistan. And RAWA's website and our website is a really great starting point to understand what's happening there and to figure out who to support.
And this is my very last question, because I know you have a baby at home that you need to take care of. So to break this down, I do understand that Afghanistan is such a very complicated issue. Is it fair to say that if we would like to weigh in on what President Obama does, is it fair to say get out?
Definitely. And you know, I mean, if you just need a small slogan that's going to fit on your placard, the first step is U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. Now, if any of your listeners ever have the chance to sit down and either talk to one of Obama's supporters or maybe write a letter to them or talk to somebody in the Obama administration, tell them that pulling the troops out is a first step, and there are many other steps that we really owe the Afghan people, but pulling out is the very first and most important step.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Sonali Kolhatkar, and it's really been great. I appreciate you giving us some time this morning, Saturday morning, with your baby. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, and thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for, you know, paying attention to this war that it's only getting worse. So, and thanks to all your listeners for listening.
And you as well. I just want to mention to listeners that you do. I was listening to a lot of your radio shows last night on the KPFK.org website, and you can follow it through to Uprising Radio. And Sonali does a wonderful show every day, and all her shows are posted on the web, so you can listen to the archives. So thank you so much for the work that you do. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. And support public radio, folks.
Yes.
Important.
Thanks so much. You have a good weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. And we are going to take a really quick break. But first, before we do that, I would like to thank so much to the people that have made the second hour of The Point Is possible. We're leading into the second hour, and this will be made possible by member contributions and by Turkey Tail Farm, a family farm providing Butte County with ecologically conscious agriculture. Turkey Tail Farm offers farm sale shares delivered to you each week. They include fresh meat, poultry, mushrooms, greens, and other seasonally harvested foods. For more information, you can contact Turkey Tail Farm at 774-6270, or you can go to the web at www.turkeytailfarm.net. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to do a quick check-in with Ben Davenport, who's in Washington, D.C. right now at the Power Shift Conference. Over 11,000 students have descended on Washington, D.C. to demand that our elected officials really take seriously climate change and start investing and developing alternative green energy sources. And then we're going to turn to Ryan Lieber, who has spent the last 7 years taking photos, fabulous, fabulous photos, about the people in Southeast Asia and other areas. So don't go away. We'll be right back with The Point Is on KZFR.
One, a two, a one, two. The dollar went down and the president's sick. Who's in charge now? I don't know. Take your pick. A new disease every day and the old ones are coming back. Things are looking kind of gray, like they're gonna get black. Don't turn on the TV, don't show me the paper. Don't wanna know he got kidnapped or why they all raped him. I wanna go on vacation till the pressure lets up. They keep hijacking airplanes and blowing them up. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth. It's hot in December, cold in July. When it rains, it pours out of a poisonous sky. In California, the body counts keep getting higher. It's evil out there, man, that state is always on fire. Everyone has a system, but they can't seem to win. Even Bob Geldof looks alarmingly thin. I got to get on that shuttle, get me out of this place. But there's gonna be warfare up there in outer space. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? It's getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth. I got clothes on my back and shoes on my feet. A roof over my head and something to eat. My kids are all healthy and my folks are alive. You know, it's amazing, but sometimes I think I'll survive. I got all of my fingers, all of my toes. I'm pretty well off, I guess, I suppose. So how come I feel bad so much of the time? A man ain't an island. John Donne wasn't lying. It's been a hard day on the planet. How much is it all worth? It's getting harder to understand it. Things are tough all over on Earth. It's business as usual. Some things never change. It's unfair and unkind and unjust, and it's strange. We don't seem to learn, we can't seem to stop. I suppose some explosions might close up the shop, and you know, maybe that would be fine, because we would be off the hook, man. We resolved all the problems, never mind what it took, man. And it all would be over, finito the end, until the survivors started up all over again. It'll be a hard day on the planet. All over.